Now, an investigation from Politico has found that the arm of the FDA that deals with food safety and regulation is so dysfunctional that people who work for the agency sometimes joke that the F in FDA is silent. About 3,000 Americans die and more than 128,000 Americans are hospitalized from foodborne illness every year. The FDA regulates about 80% of the U.S. food supply, but Politico's investigation found a wide variety of problems and a very slow process for fixing them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the safety of your food? Have you had a problem with a foodborne illness yourself? Have you had trouble buying baby formula lately? What questions do you have about food safety and how it's regulated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Helena Bada-Miller-Evich is a senior food and agriculture reporter at Politico. Her investigation into the FDA is called the FDA's Food Failure. Helena, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You cover a lot of ground in this report, Helena. What led you down this road? What led you to check out these shortcomings in food safety enforcement?
So I've been covering food policy for a really long time. And what's interesting about this story is it's actually not news to folks who are in food policy or in the food sector that food is a, you know, backseat issue at FDA, that it takes forever to really move any policies forward on food safety or nutrition. What I did here was basically take a step back and sort of explain it for everyone, right? And really do a deep dive of the structural and cultural and political reasons why things are so dysfunctional at FDA.
Yeah, I want to mention a couple of the symptoms, and you could tell us why things are the way they are. One thing that struck me, there was a, I think it was a spinach-related foodborne illness. You know, water contaminated hits the spinach, hits the people, causes a lot of harm. By the time action is taken, the spinach growing season in that region is done. Can you tell us a little more about that and why the kind of response we'd hope for wasn't there?
Yeah, produce safety is a really tough one because for things like spinach and romaine lettuce, sometimes when the government, by the time the government figures out what it is that's making people sick, sometimes those products are no longer on the market, or oftentimes, like you said, the season is over. And so it's really impossible to pinpoint what the actual problem was. It's really common in these produce outbreaks to actually not have a recall because it just wasn't solved in time for a recall to matter. And even when there are recalls, sometimes they take a month or 2 months, in one case, even 4 months into when people start getting sick. So I think when consumers look at some of these timelines, it's reasonable to ask, you know, whether or not we can do better.
Another symptom here, people might have trouble finding infant and baby formula, concerns about heavy metals in those. How does the food enforcement part of the FDA fit into that story?
Yeah, the heavy metals in baby food issue has been getting a lot more attention in the past couple of years as like consumer advocacy groups and health groups have done their own testing of baby food to screen for things like lead and arsenic and cadmium and mercury, these toxic elements that can be found at low levels in a lot of different foods, but we become really concerned about babies because they're just uniquely vulnerable. You know, CDC has said there's no safe level of lead exposure, for example. So when we're seeing levels of lead come up in baby food, that's something that's gotten a lot of attention. But even though there's been these outside reports year after year after year, consumer advocates year after year asking FDA to set standards for heavy metals in baby food, they still largely haven't. And so that's one of those areas where I think parents look at it and they're just kind of befuddled. So is the food industry. I mean, a lot of food and food companies would like there to be standards so that there's sort of a level playing field and an understanding of, you know, what the guardrails are.
Helena, those are just a couple of the examples of, you know, what the public might end up encountering. What's going on inside the FDA that leads them to be slow or even non-responsive to those and other concerns?
Yeah, so the story really unpacks a lot of reasons that can, you know, a lot of reasons why FDA is so slow and dysfunctional on food issues. I think it starts with the structure. So FDA is housed under the Department of Health and Human Services. So it's a little bit lower down in the government. The commissioner is Senate confirmed, but, you know, they're below cabinet level, right? So FDA is overall just a little bit further down in the government. And then the FDA commissioner almost always has no experience or real background in food issues. They're usually physicians, or they have a background in clinical research or medical devices or the drug side. So it kind of leads to a situation where the dynamic over time is just that food is a lesser tier issue. And then we have some structural and cultural problems within the actual food division. I reported on an open power struggle between the top two officials in the foods division. And really right now we don't have anyone in charge of food at FDA. It's unclear from the outside who's actually in charge and who's making decisions. And I think that only adds to the dysfunction. There's also the fact that Capitol Hill really doesn't hold FDA accountable on many of these issues. So there's really like a long list of reasons why the agency just doesn't act on a lot of the issues that I think consumers expect it to be handling.
We're talking to Politico's food and agriculture reporter, Helena Bottomiller-Evich, about her investigation into shortfalls at the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, on the food part of the equation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten sick from food that you thought had been safe to eat? What do you want to know about food safety regulations and how the FDA does or doesn't enforce them? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Helena Bottomiller-Evich is with us from Politico. Her investigation into the FDA found the agency is not doing its job properly when it comes to food safety. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the solution when the FDA isn't using its power to protect people the way it's intended to? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. I was a delivery man in the food industry for many years. I delivered to institutions as well as grocery stores and restaurants. And I saw repeated violations that I didn't report, but I witnessed them enough to where, as a consumer, I made my choices carefully. But when I lived in Chicago, I saw a solution that made sense to me. When the federal government or state government doesn't respond, the city of Chicago used to actually close down some of these businesses because they had inspectors that went around and saw violations that weren't addressed by other levels of government. And I thought that was very effective because it kept my customers that I delivered to on their toes so that there were no violations.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And Helena, I think it's pretty common for a local government to have restaurant inspections for sure and grocery store inspections. At what level is the FDA supposed to be checking out food?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there definitely is a role for local governments here. I mean, they tend to know, you know, their local communities and businesses well. The state agencies actually do a lot of inspections for the FDA. So on behalf of the FDA, they actually do the bulk of food safety inspections. So they're the ones that are actually going into like more like food manufacturing plants, so not restaurants. And not really like retail establishments, which it sounds like that's what the caller is referencing. And, you know, I'm glad to hear them speaking up on that. I think there's definitely still room for improvement. But FDA is really supposed to be taking care of the plants that are, you know, distributing food like across state lines and more across the country. So one thing that I reported in my story was the fact that food safety inspections, the number of routine inspections is actually going down right now, even though Congress has been giving FDA more resources. So that is one question that members of Congress and consumer advocates have raised, you know, is FDA really making the best use of its resources right now? And, you know, do consumers expect them to be inspecting these food plants more often than they are?
Thanks again for that call. Helena, one issue we haven't gotten into is nutrition. Now, we've been talking about food safety before. The FDA also is supposed to have a big role in nutrition, and that's been frustrating some consumer groups, some people in the food industry. What did you find out there?
So FDA has been, for the better part of a decade, working on sodium reduction. So the agency has been working to put together essentially goals for the food industry to try to get all these different food categories like pickles and pizza and pretzels and all the different, you know, subcategories, bread, and get each category to cut sodium over time, right? So it's not mandatory, it's not regulatory, but they are setting goals to try to get the entire industry to meet. And one thing that has really frustrated consumer advocates is just how long it has taken for FDA to get that policy finalized. The Institute of Medicine asked FDA to work on sodium reduction in 2010, and FDA just finalized some of these voluntary goals in the fall of 2021. So that's an 11-year timeline. Certainly, there was a lot of industry pushback. There were a lot of political concerns here. But you zoom out and these long timelines, whether they're food safety or nutrition, kind of become a pattern for the agency. And it really frustrates outside groups. And it also frustrates the food industry, quite frankly, because if you're a company that wants to cut sodium, you want to go with everyone, right? You want your competitors to all kind of dial down sodium at the same time so that you're not put at a disadvantage when it comes to taste. You want to have sort of consistency in the marketplace. And they also want to know where FDA is headed. So these timelines that span years and years and years really add a layer of uncertainty for the food industry. In addition to the public health impact, FDA itself estimates that if you were to cut sodium across the food supply, you could save tens of thousands of lives every year just by reducing rates of hypertension and cardiovascular disease. So it's not an abstract, you know, policy. It is projected to have a real public health impact.
And just our last few moments, Selena, is there a solution, a main solution that people you talked to pointed toward to help fix some of this?
It's a really tough question. I think there's a lot of ideas swirling around right now. Potentially, you know, one thing that's been proposed is trying to take the food portion of FDA out of the agency and create a new independent agency that maybe would combine some of the food safety functions at USDA. I think that's a really tall order, really politically difficult, if not impossible, to do that. Another thing is to try to give the agency more money so that they have better staffing levels to handle some of these complex issues. There's also a call to have more transparency over how the agency is currently spending its money. And then there's, I think, some conversation about whether or not FDA's food program might need to be reorganized in some way. So you just have a more clear leadership structure, because right now they are most certainly in an open power struggle. And I think everyone agrees that's problematic.
Helena, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Helena Bottomiller-Evich is a senior food and agriculture reporter at Politico. She joined us to talk about her investigation into the FDA and its role in food safety. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. COVID-19 numbers are way lower in the U.S. lately compared to the beginning of this year, both in terms of the number of positive tests and of hospitalizations and deaths from the disease. Speaking on PBS NewsHour this week, U.S. Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said we're in a new phase of the disease.
We are certainly right now in this country out of the pandemic phase. Namely, we don't have 900,000 new infections a day and tens and tens and tens of thousands of hospitalizations and thousands of deaths. We are at a low level right now.
Dr. Fauci ended up dialing back that statement a bit, telling CNN that, quote, we're not over the pandemic, and that what he meant to say is that the U.S. is currently in a transitional phase on the way to better control of the virus. Dr. Patrick Remington is an emeritus professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences and director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob. Thanks.
Can you help us make some sense of what Dr. Fauci was saying about sort of where we are in this pandemic?
Well, I think this is an example of a soundbite gone bad. Mm-hmm. To say that we're no longer in a pandemic phase or the acute phase of a pandemic can be misinterpreted to mean that we don't have a problem with COVID. I like to think about the Greek origins of the word pandemic. Pan means everything, everybody, and demos means people. So we are clearly in a pandemic in Wisconsin, in the nation, and worldwide, because everybody is potentially at risk. And we still have many people getting infected. Yesterday in Wisconsin, over 1,600 people got infected. But the reason he's saying that we're not in the worst part of the pandemic is yesterday in Wisconsin, there were no recorded deaths. Mm-hmm. So we are down probably from January, which was the highest rate of the COVID, we're 1/16th the rate we were. So 16 times higher in January compared to today. So that's the reason he's reassuring us that we're in a different phase of the pandemic.
And one thing I've learned over the course of the last couple of years is there's not really an on-off switch kind of definition of pandemic. It means something, but it's not like you hit a certain measure and the pandemic ends, right?
That's correct. We like to think that, you know, certain ways we can define a phase, but it is very hard to the word pandemic simply means that everybody is affected. But what does it mean to be affected? Is it people getting an illness like influenza? Sometimes influenza becomes pandemic. That's different than a pandemic that leads to many deaths. So, and even the word pan, it can mean a pandemic in a country. If everyone in a country is affected, then that can be a pandemic. So I think the most important thing to focus on is that we're better off than we were in January, but we're not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, we see in the numbers some slight upticks in the number of positive cases. When I look at the national numbers and the Wisconsin numbers in some cases lately, as you say, hospitalizations and deaths looking a lot better. I mean, the key, though, is even if they tick up a little, things look really good compared to some of the high points, or I should say low points we've had over the last couple of years.
Yeah, the high points are the low points, right. Really. It's always relative to what happened recently. So I would agree that we've ticked up a bit from 2 to 3 weeks ago. But again, if you simply go to the CDC website or Google COVID-19 and look at the graph, you see these three distinct peaks. January 2021, where many people were getting COVID and there was no vaccine and we had a lot of people dying. And then in the fall of 2021, when Delta came, and then in January, when Omicron surprised everybody, well, not the experts. Experts anticipated that there would be a variant that was more contagious, but it certainly surprised many of us. And one day in January, January 10th, we had 1 million cases, 1 million people diagnosed on a single day. Today, we're down to maybe 85,000. So that's a lot, still a lot of people. One day on August 27th to be diagnosed, but it's not the million that we were seeing in early January.
Now, we saw federal health data released earlier this week that found that nearly 60% of Americans have had COVID at some point. That's based on an interesting kind of survey, a survey of blood tests. Can you tell us more about that and what it means?
It's a very interesting survey because many of these numbers we get from people who happen to go in to get a test, but in a facility, we don't know about home tests. People might have symptoms. People might not have symptoms. So the question is, how many people have actually been infected is really hard to answer. But this very innovative study looked at blood samples, assuming that people who donate blood are generally representative of the population. They looked at antibodies, and this test can differentiate an antibody from natural infection from an antibody that results from a vaccine. They both protect against illness, but they look different. And so 60% of the blood samples that they looked at had evidence of natural infection. Now, some of those people also had antibodies with the vaccine, and they would be really doubly protected. They would have natural immunity, but also the immunity from a vaccine. The timing isn't clear, but they may have had a breakthrough infection with, for example, with the Omicron variant. And those individuals, although they got infected, their illness is certainly going to be less severe and they were less likely to get infected in the first place.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences, looking at the latest COVID numbers, questions about where we are at this stage of the pandemic. Dr. Remington, I think something on a lot of people's minds, parents of kids under five. Another request now, I think, to the FDA looking at the possibility of a vaccine for those young kids who can't get it yet. What is the latest on that?
Well, that vaccine has been tested. It's been shown to be effective and it's been shown to be safe. None of the serious side effects that potentially can come from a vaccine have been observed in that population. And again, if you think back from the 1960s on, we have been introducing vaccines all along to prevent terrible illnesses like measles, mumps, rubella, and the like. And these have often spent years in trials to make sure that the vaccines are both safe and effective. We're seeing that accelerated today. So this large study, they are asking for emergency use authorization from the FDA to vaccinate kids. But the information from the study is that this vaccine is likely to be effective and is the research shows that it's safe. And again, it's been kind of a nightmare for parents of young kids who go into daycare, for example, or preschool settings, and they might bring the infection home to mom and dad, all of whom hopefully are fully vaccinated. But we know that the vaccine is not perfect. Some people, despite being vaccinated and boosted, have a breakthrough infection. And so it would be ideal if we could stop transmission in all group settings. And daycare and preschool are settings that still are not protected from vaccinations.
Dr. Remington, I want to take the long view for a moment. I was looking back. I talked to you in early March of 2020. I was in our Wausau studio. I remember this thing was just getting rolling. And I remember I looked at the numbers in Italy and tried to do some simple math. Like if it hit us like it was hitting Italy then, we would come out with like something like 30,000 to 60,000 deaths from this disease. And I thought, that's terrible. Like that's an extra flu season on top of the actual flu season. Now we're knocking on the door, the official count of almost a million deaths. I don't know. Take a long view for us, how we got from there to here.
Rob, I think it's really a good idea to take a long view. And fortunately, there's records of what people were saying. And experts in the Trump administration were saying that they feared anywhere between 150 to 250,000 people would die from COVID. And we went through that relatively quickly. The fortunate thing is the vaccine became available, and that has significantly reduced what could have been 2 million deaths. But right now we are at about 990,000 deaths, and at 400 deaths a day, it'll be a week or two when we have 1 million people who've died. The CDC just today came out with the death data from 2021. COVID is the third leading cause of death behind only heart disease and cancer. And that is absolutely phenomenal. And anybody who doubts this, they're sleeping under a rock, because you don't have to go very far, certainly, to know somebody's been really sick or even died from this disease. But just look at the data coming out of CDC and how they've presented it. It was unexpected. I think obviously some experts feared that this would happen, but nobody was predicting a million deaths publicly in 2020. And here we are within weeks of passing that unfortunate milestone.
In just our last minute or so, Dr. Remington, there will be other diseases, other pandemics in the future, hopefully not as bad as this. Do you have a quick lesson learned you might want to share with us?
Yeah, the lesson learned is we need to be ready. We need to have public health systems that are ready. We need to have healthcare systems that are ready. We can't just go back to the same old system of lack of preparedness. Finally, we just have to, as a community, understand that we need to work together, not just to protect ourselves, to do the right things, to get vaccinated, but to do it collectively, to really be responsible to others and do what it takes, whether it's a mask order, whether it's being quarantined if you've been exposed or isolated if you're ill. We all have to do this together. It does take a village, really to overcome some of the challenges that a virus like COVID or the next virus that comes around.
Dr. Remington, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Have a good day.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Emeritus Professor at the UW-Madison Department of Population Health Sciences and Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program. He talked to us about the state of the pandemic.